Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I should like to thank Andreas Bruckmann for inviting me to Lüneburg and to the various members of this symposium who have tried to make it so easy for me to get here. Sophie, and to Mark for your organizational skills. We'd first heard of Lüneburg many years ago, maybe in the late 90s, when one of the most celebrated art curators of our time, Hans Ulrich Obrist, used to visit a place called Lüneburg and report to us at Goldsmiths College at the University of London about the archive being built up in Lüneburg. We translated Lüneburg quite literally as a mountain on the moon. And ever since, I've always wanted to visit Lüneburg to see this kind of lunar landscape. So it, a loony landscape, one might want to add jovially to the phrase. But I'm delighted here to be here to address this rather interesting topic that Andreas has set before us. How does art research, how does art practice of an art school interact with the university setting? Is it entirely engulfed and gobbled up by the university? Or is there the possibility of some sort of fruitful interaction to begin, which might in fact lead to some sort of new mapping of what we understand by knowledge and by research? Is that a possibility? I think one wants to phrase it as a wary sort of question and with a strong dose of skepticism, because if we speak of research and knowledge production, then surely these are propositions yet to be tested, examined, scrutinized, and assessed all along the way. Perhaps we never have a conclusion to the thing, but the point is that it is under scrutiny and under examination. I felt, however, that the question of the art school, the university, notions of knowledge and research could not be raised today especially, without us taking on board what Jürgen Habermas had called knowledge and its interests, that knowledge is not entirely a disinterested kind of phenomenon, that it does have interests, that it does have links, that it does have connections with the world of a kind which can often be quite at odds with what we assume to be the disinterested pursuit of knowledge. Habermas does sound rather old-fashioned today, precisely because for him, society is made up of agents involved in the most rational of discourses and deliberations with each other. They are often of a homogeneous background, but the societies in which we speak of knowledge and art practice today are highly scarred and scoured and inflected and accentuated by the immigrations of our time. And therefore, we are speaking of a far more heterogeneous society in which many notions of rationality come under question, and therefore Habermas's general view of communicative interaction in which research and knowledge is produced might be under deeper question today than it was in its original presentation. However, this notion of interest of knowledge and the interests of knowledge today are at stake when we look around us at the demonstrations that began last year from the Slade School of Art itself, the most establishment of art schools in Britain, which led as a feeder demonstration into the larger demonstration which echoed through the city of London in November and January last year, right through to this very day, today. These demonstrations which ask the question, what is knowledge, what is education for, can one today get an education at all? Is education simply education for jobs? Is it education for the work regime? Or is education and knowledge to do with something else altogether? Is education itself just a luxury commodity, as we will find in England from next year, when each degree begins to cost £9,000 a year, and that this very level of financial investment that must go into an education puts into question what we mean by education and to what extent a society's commitment to education in a modern knowledge economy is something guaranteed over and beyond whether one can afford it. Today, the job figures for young people between the age of 16 and 24 in Britain has reached the 1 million mark of unemployed, which is devastating news. And in fact, such figures, which were not kept before the 1990s, I'm rather surprised to find out, but in fact, such figures were only matched in the depression of the 1930s. So these interests that shape the field of knowledge, education, and the possibility of going into an art school to study art must form the basis of our scrutiny today of what we understand by research and knowledge. And these overarching factors, fees, the nature of education, is education only for work? Is research only a contribution towards the smooth efficiency and productivity of the knowledge economy? Or is it about values over and beyond that sort of logic of survival and efficiency? So these overarching factors, which have made for the unrest, for the anxiety and the general uncertainty today, are the ones that we want to just possibly map out and look at a little more closely. May we look, Sophie, at the first slide? I just hope to evoke a little bit the beginnings of the demonstrations last year. Is there something that I should turn down, a light or so? Oh, I see.
It's the kind of thing I'd rather not.
Yes.
Wissen Sie, wie das geht?
Vielleicht könnten wir noch.
Oh, that. This is a demonstration of the books. The books go out on demonstration because of the cuts. The books representative of some embodiment, some archiving of knowledge. And because it had all my slightly favorite books, I rather liked the photograph. It's got Adorno's Negative Dialectics, as you can see. Hidden, the orange book, is really James Joyce's Ulysses. So my hobby horse. And then Ruskin's fantastic work, Unto This Last, which was one of the earliest critiques of Marx and the Marxian labor theory of value, and which was deeply to inspire Mahatma Gandhi, who translated this work in South Africa. So there are many historical and personal connections when Gandhi translated this work of Ruskin's later in the century. And of course, Griffith's book, Pip Pip, is an astonishingly exciting novel and highly imaginative and beautiful use of contemporary colloquial English of a sort that I rather find links up with the James Joyce. But anyway, this is the demonstration of the books. And you can see that there is a joyousness, there is a sense of celebration, but also a sense of anxiety that we are coming to have to walk out onto the streets of London in order to remind again and again the city that there are other values to the world of education and to what we might understand by knowledge in our time. What are these other values? It's very hard for us to get a grip of this, especially when day in and day out we are so focused on all education as leading to the workplace, and as all education being centered around the workplace, on getting a job, with the result that at Lund, we set up the research project from which this presentation takes various snippets, which focuses on four institutions and agencies of our time. The first, the factory. It examines the life of the factory. Secondly, the university and the art academy. The third institution that it looks at is the job center. And the job center has been studied by a group of researchers and students with me, both in Sweden and in England. And the fourth institution of our time in this system of knowledge productions, where the production of knowledge as dogma and doctrine takes place, is the Islamic madrasa. So these four institutions, the madrasa, the factory, the university, academy, and the job center, where we look for jobs and where we get a job seeker's allowance, which is the government giving us credit for being in search of work. Otherwise, one is part of the 1 million unemployed. And it is this notion of the jobless state that I have set up as our research topic. And if you could perhaps just give a second to listen to the double meaning of the jobless state in English, that it is a state in which I find myself, a condition, an existential condition. I'm without job, I'm filled with anxiety about it. But then there is a state which in a way orchestrates joblessness. There is that echo or resonance to the phrase. And beyond that, the question, is joblessness perhaps not also a creative and positive state to be in? Can one think along those lines? Painful as it is to be without a job, can society think of itself as less oriented on jobs, on having a job, of being defined by a job, of being humanized through jobs and having a job? And what would this other state of joblessness add up to? Could it be a state of creativity? Could it be a state of self-knowledge? Could it be a state of the production of consciousness of a kind which we brush aside in the general drive to be defined by job and work? I'll leave those sets of questions as the larger philosophical ambient in which we might want to discuss some of these issues. This is the larger research project from Lund to London. To flesh out the question that Andreas has posed, how does knowledge interact when it's art research with university research? And he's asked that I should stick to specific examples, concrete institutions, the ones that I will have bear in mind and I'm thinking of all the time, is the University of London, Goldsmiths College, and the Slade, from which this image is derived. Some of the students here from the Slade School of Art, which in fact surprisingly took the lead in many of the demonstrations and is still taking the lead in asking these questions, which resonate today with Occupy, the London Stock Exchange, the occupation in front of St. Paul's, and this very afternoon at 3 o'clock, as we know, in New York, the university students have gone on demonstration, partly also in this notion of Occupy London, Occupy New York, Occupy Delhi, Occupy Beijing and Sydney. I'm leaving out Europe here because Europe, for those of us who come from the other side of the English Channel, from the provincial side, tend to be a little bit puzzled by what's happening in Europe. And maybe I'm speaking about these things in the wrong country, because Germany appears to us from a distance to be a secure island in which these questions have barely raised their heads and do not disturb your nights, as it were. So Malmö art academies, since Malmö is not just one academy, it's the film academy created by Ingmar Bergman. It is the visual arts academy, it's a music, opera, theatre academy, so the whole range of academies that are part of the University of Lund. The Jan van Eyck Academy, which stands as one of the centres for post-academic research, so we should be interested in what that sort of institution says to us. And then my last body of empirical evidence is drawn from two other places, from the experimental space at the UDAKA in Berlin, run by Olafur Eliasson, and then from the China Art Academy, where I am also a teacher, and of course from the post-colonial academies of India, South Africa, and of course the largest art academy in Europe, which has now opened up in its new premises and campus in London, the University of the Creative Arts. And I'm puzzled in English that there should be this lack of understatement in this underlined creative arts. What is meant by the creative arts? It seems as though we're gilding the lily. So there is a body of examination through these institutions through which we should focus on the conditions under which knowledge is being produced, the shape of the institutions in this sort of climate of uncertainty, and what could we mean by research and inquiry in such a setup? In complete opposite to this, to these ambiente factors, is what I would call the immanent drive in the universities, the internal tectonics, as it were, of the disciplines. That the academic disciplines we think have been settled once and for all. They were shaped at the Renaissance, and then, of course, after the Enlightenment, with the Napoleonic reforms, the various subjects were set up in the university, and they're there forever and ever. But really, when one examines the situation, you find that they are unstable and shifting disciplines, that disciplines have never been entirely stable. And I think we got a whiff of it in the about 15 or 20 years ago, when there was a great deal of talk about the death of a discipline, the end of history, the death of the author, the end of man. You can see these themes from French post-structuralist thinking that deeply shaped works like the post-colonial critique of English as a subject by Gayatri Spivak in her work with Edward Said. They framed a critique of the way many of these subjects were taught and understood in universities of the United States as a whole, but they came to affect the rest of our understanding of the subject. It also comes as a little bit of a surprise when we find that while there is all this talk about death of disciplines, death of particular canons, death of particular departments, there is also the moment of the birth of a subject such as art research, that suddenly this unknown thing pops up and it's the talk of the town, and everybody's into art research and wondering what it could be like. In fact, again, in that overstated use of English language, it is also called artistic research, as though research itself could be a little bit fancy. And that's a funny use of the term. But just art research, what could we mean by this? And what form does it take? I think the sheer diversity at the moment of our understanding must be held on to. We shouldn't close this down too quickly. There are many ways in which we might understand art research and the birth of art research. But it does come as a bit of a surprise when we think disciplines are there and new ones are born, but they're not really true disciplines. They're going to fade away, or they'll be really conveniently parked on the side of some other older major discipline. So yes, of course you'll do feminism, but then it'll be a subsection of the old department. You will do some post-colonial studies, but that too will be neatly and conveniently brushed under the carpet of the history department. But that isn't quite true. If you really look at the history of disciplines, you do see some really surprising and big changes. You see, for example, what a fierce debate took place in Cambridge about the introduction of all things, believe it or not, of English as a subject and as a discipline. That until the 30s, the prestige lay in studying Latin and Greek at Oxford and Cambridge. The idea of studying English, what a vulgar thought. And how common, and how completely, you know, the whole snooty class structure comes into play. How on earth could you have ever have dreamt up a subject like English literature to be studied or English language to be studied? Of course not. That's something you're born into. You don't study it. You study Latin and Greek. These are the objects of study. They're given, they're received, they're legitimated over centuries. So the legitimation of English as a field of study in the way we are at the moment involved in the argument over the validation of art research as a field of study is very interesting to compare. The great figure was F.R. Leavis, Frank Leavis, who invented modern English studies, and he was the subject of a lot of criticism. In fact, his wife was called Queenie Leavis, and in many instances, people mistook him for being a queen and assumed that it was all to do with homosexuality or something of the kind, which at the time was taboo. So you can see every prejudice from gender, sexuality, academic legitimacy come into play just around the name of the Leavises, as it were. And for a long time, sociology had no place in the old universities of England, because sociology was, after all, studied through English literature. Where could you understand class and class power relations better than in studying Jane Austen or studying George Eliot? Where could a single sentence suggest to you the withering nature of a class comment or a class attitude, or how one treated those who were lower than one on the social hierarchy and the social scale? A line from Jane Austen, in fact, is often worth thicker books on sociology, on class. And I do feel this is true. In this instance, maybe the academic world was right. But sociology does come in late in the day. So let's bear this in mind, that the instability of the constellation of disciplines, the constantly shifting tectonics of academic fields, the arrival and the disappearance of other fields of study, and it is in this field of dynamic movement and dynamic behavior that we should understand the notion of research in visual arts practice today and as it enters the university through the academies. We should see it not entering a stable field, but as the instability of the university subjects themselves in relationship to the kinds of instability brought in by art research and by the art world. I'll leave that body of ideas there, just to remind ourselves that if it's surprising when you look at Benedetto Croce speaking about the importance of history, and he's almost saying, but philosophy too is an important subject. So it is as though in the hierarchy of subjects at that particular time in Italy, there is less importance given to philosophical thought as opposed to historical thought. So this hierarchy has to be borne in mind. When we come to the 1940s and we listen to Gaston Bachelard in trying to define the new science, or the spirit of the new sciences as he called it, Bachelard is saying, but why should philosophy be the master discipline? why should philosophy undertake to explain all other disciplines to us? Philosophy is, after all, just one. Leave it to the disciplines to actually make up their own meta story about what they are doing. And of course, Bachelard also asks us to think, is there such a thing as science, or are there many scientific practices? Now, that's a kind of knowledge that we feel artists had quite a long time ago, that, to put it in Gombrich's phrase, the art historian Gombrich, there's no such thing as art, there are only artists. There's no such thing as art, with capital letters, in Marcel Duchamp. He asks, how can I make a work of art that will not belong to art, in capital letters? The constant refusal to accept the fact that there might be an established discipline with its canons, traditions, and so on. I think these are very important notions that we need to bear in mind in thinking about knowledge production through art in our time. Sophie, may we have the next image? In order to look at this larger set, the larger framework for the subject, I thought I'd just show you the conditions under which one might have to think about knowledge and knowledge production and its relationship to the general scene of production, what I call the emergence in our time of the global assembly line, that none of us is any more simply a producer in a particular national territory. To use Ulrich Beck, the great sociologist at Munich, phrase, that the national container no more functions as a vehicle through which we understand the space in which we find ourselves. The contemporary space is a space that transcends the notion of the national territory, and the global assembly line connects us one to the other in ways that we might find surprising at times we might find painful, in the sense that work continually gets outsourced to parts of the world which we need to do the dirty manufacture for us in order to benefit from it, but at the same time we are losers in the sense that jobs go elsewhere. So in this convoluted and complicated setup, our understanding of production and the global assembly line becomes very, I think, a very crucial point. Largely, we say we are in the world of a knowledge economy, and I rather prefer Marcel Duchamp's phrase, the grey matter economy, the grey matter referring to that porridge that is here held in our skull. He's referring to this dull porridge-coloured material. And this is largely the exit from an old system of production, which we'll just skip the random period of the Artelia, but maybe you just want to mark 1913 as a rather important date, since bicycle production really leads the field in mass production concepts for industrial society. It's first tested out with bicycle production, and not with the motor car. The motor car learns actually from bicycle production, and I'm always interested that one of the first ready-mades of Marcel Duchamp was a bicycle wheel, which he loved moving in his studio on 1913. But we leave aside the art references on the left-hand column and just simply focus on the Ford Model T, which is the origins of mass and volume production, which becomes the classic mode of production for industrial society. Everything from food production to clothes production will eventually follow the techniques and the procedures established by Henry Ford. And today it's loosely called the Ford system, and we're supposedly in a post-Ford kind of economy. But I think the story is more complicated than that, because at the end of the war, the Ford system had already reached a kind of ceiling in what it could do with the resources it had, and was already in some difficulty. because what had sprung up at the end of the war, of the Second World War, was a new system of production with Toyota in Japan, and this system would be called lean production. Lean production would give the Ford system a lot of running for its money. In fact, we could have had tremendous wars of protectionism during the time, except that Japan was largely coming out of its period of defeat, and as a reconstituted nation, then joined hands with the United States to form a new system of production, which I think we need to bear in mind as the core of what I call the gray matter economy, in which we have to define what is knowledge and research for our time. The Ford method of factory work, I'm sure you all understand it from the Charlie Chaplin films you must have seen, that you are standing there, things are passing by at great speed, and you are supposed to just do your job, and the less you have in your head, the better. Ford wanted your head to be absolutely empty, and it is a condition I call mindlessness. I'm using Buddhist terms here to describe factory production, because I think one needs, as Ulrich Beck constantly stresses in The Search for a Cosmopolitan Methodology, we constantly need to bring in the experience of the world in understanding the contemporary. Mindlessness, maybe it sounds like a very Zen state of mind to be in, but it is rather soul-destroying to be in a factory, mindless, doing your job and things passing in front of you. During this period, in Sweden, in a small town called Uddevalla, in the hinterland of the Gotha, there emerged, for some reason or the other, because shipbuilding industries had shut down and so on, they emerged a kind of experiment between 89 to 93, an experiment in the factory at Uddevalla to change Volvo motor car making so that it wouldn't be like the mindlessness of the Ford factory, but the Uddevalla system would be working around a table where workers would gather round a table, as it were, or the car jacked up, and working round it as though they were working with a work of art, a sculptural work, or maybe saying a work of art is pushing it a bit. Maybe we should say working as though someone was tinkering and toying with their motor car on a Sunday afternoon in a suburb, somewhere in the backyard, that kind of attitude to production. They decided their timetables together. They decided who will work on what part of the motor car, and they decided their holiday, their leisure time, their creative time, their education time together in a cell or a bay, in which they then produced these very beautiful Volvo cars. And their customers visited the factories, apparently. We've just done lots of interviews with surviving workers from the period. And people would come to the factory to discuss things they wanted put into their motor car. So it was almost like bespoke and unique tailoring, where a suit was made for you. And in many ways, this was what the Swedes called the search for a more humane view of work, a more humanized approach to production. However, this, by the 90s, by the late 80s, really, came to be less favorably looked upon by competition from the United States, many people say, and competition from other sources. There was much correspondence and visiting between German workers and German car production in the Ruhr region and Uddevalla, and the correspondence between the trade unions of the two countries is very interesting literature to look at to understand what one might have meant by humane approaches to work. Can work ever be humane? Is it always a dehumanizing experience? The mindlessness of the Ford system suggests it is. Our own reluctance to be 24 hours stuck in work and job must also remind us about the dehumanizing, if not demeaning, nature of work, especially when we look at work throughout the history of civilization. It was never a favored thing. Slavery is based on the idea that work is to be done by someone else. And in the history of civilizations, it's probably only in the last 70 to 100 years that we have come to believe that we are defined entirely by a job and by work, and that without work we are not a citizen. We gain our place in society and our citizenship through holding a job. As we leave this society, as we leave the industrial model of full employment, having a job, having citizenship, we enter a world where we would have to think of work differently. And this is where creative labor comes into the story. What we mean by creativity and what creative work could take the place of this dehumanizing work that normally took up 100% of our time. Could this space be expanded? Could the space of non-work, as I call it, in Sanskrit, the ancient language of India, nishkam karma, that is work, but totally detached work, in which you are not defined by the process of labor itself. There are many philosophical notions that come into play here, but at Uddevalla, this whole experiment is scotched and brought to an end by 1993 as Toyota and Ford form an alliance and create what we call the numinization. I won't go into all this terminology, but the new system is a meta-mindful system. If we had mindlessness, at Uddevalla we have a mindful system. You are mindful of labor, creativity, relations between people. Whereas with the new system that emerges, meta-mindfulness, we are constantly expected to be on call with the job at hand. In two ways. In the factory space, that the factory worker now is constantly observing ways through which one could improve factory production, in which one is put, as it were, on a kind of watch to see how things could be innovated. Innovation becomes the key principle of production in from this period onwards, from the 90s onwards, and what I call the meta-mindful state of non-stop innovation. Non-stop innovation, just as you might understand it with applications and the creation of apps, that the constant renovation, constant upgrading, constant production of the new becomes the principle of creativity, is understood as creativity, described as creativity. But is it creativity? Or is it, as I call it, non-stop innovation? Some distinctions have to be drawn, therefore, in the four terms I feel that center around the notion of creativity: invention, discovery, innovation, and creativity. These four have to be unpacked and understood as quite different degrees of activity, different intensities of activity with different goals in mind. But the very structured protocol in which innovation takes place is entirely different from what we might mean by creativity in art, where there are no protocols, where the scene of creativity is an entirely unpredictable, indeterminate scene, and the lack of those protocols and boundaries, the given, as it were, of production and applications in the knowledge economy defines what the art scenes creativity must mean, that we are thrown and plunged into a borderless situation, a boundaryless situation in which there is no given pre-established, pre-existent language that we can work with. Each contemporary art must invent its language to make sense for itself. That is the only principle on which we understand contemporary art practice, and that is the degree of the gulf between our understanding of non-stop innovation versus, as it not versus in an antagonistic way, but at the other end of the spectrum, what we mean by the unpredictable scene of artistic creation. So we enter this particular scene of the knowledge economy, the grey economy, with these distinctions in mind. And I just want to sum that up by this wonderful question that Marx asks. Karl Marx asks in his preparation to Das Kapital, he asks in the Grundrisse, well, who is the real producer in society? Who is the real creator in society? Is it the person who actually makes the piano, or is it the person who plays the piano? Who would we classify as the true creator in society? The question has been answered in very different ways over about 150 years or whatever, and answered sometimes from the point of view of the person who's actually using the hammer to make the piano, sometimes answered from the point of view of the person who creates conceptually and in this mental and cerebral way some work of art that we have to listen to which we might add, but who is the real creator after Marcel Duchamp? Is it not the listener to the piano piece? So the maker, the player, and then the listener. These are the three agents of creation and production in that particular scene. And as I say, Ruskin was to contest this labor theory of value, which is at the heart of Marxist thinking, and which comes back into debates today as we struggle to find what exactly is value in a financial capitalism which seems to have values in such distorted terms, as we see all around us: economic meltdown, the crashing of societies, the breakdown of economic systems, financial ruin experienced on an individual level as pain, as tragedy, as suicide, as death, as suffering in families, but on the larger scale as whole systems coming to be seen to be based on principles that we cannot support in terms of the question posed by Ruskin and then by Gandhi against, to some extent, the labor theory of value, when, in fact, Ruskin asks, what is the value of this axe? We value it when we cut wood with it, but is it a valuable thing when we chop someone's head off with it? Where is the value? Where has the value shifted in that case? I think that question is a very interesting one for our time, that we cannot separate capitalist value, which is purely the production of capital as the productive worker, from existential and human values, which stick to the event as they stick to that particular axe. So you can see how the sources of what I call creativity cholera come today. Creativity cholera, a fever of creativity, a pandemic of creativity. Everything in our society today is described in terms of creativity. You make a little cake at home and you are praised for being so creative. Jamie Oliver's cooking, wonderful as it is supposed to bring out the creativity of our creative talents, as it were, cooking talents. We don't do mass tourism anymore. Nobody goes to Torremolinos anymore on package holidays. You are a creative tourist. You create your little trip to Peru. You do your little trips to the world, through the world, in which you are valued as a creative tourist because you have made up this narrative of the journey into the world. You don't just go to India, to Goa, or to see the Taj Mahal. For heaven's sake, you couldn't be so uncultured as to want to see the Taj Mahal. You must surely have far more interest, and you're not interested in the other who's around you in a society of high immigration. They were interesting when they were far away. For heaven's sake, they're all here in our midst. How boring. There's no exotic other, in a way, to tour. So touring and finding the exotic experience becomes in itself a drive in this society of an ideology of creativity. I would call it an ideology of creativity. Everything from cooking, tourism, do-it-yourself, gardening, knitting, crocheting, all of these activities which were once ridiculed as old-fashioned, grandmotherly, sexist, in sexist terms, as craft activities of the past, have been revamped in order to awaken in us a kind of urge to creativity. So once again, from the everyday point of view, we have to examine and scrutinize and evaluate what we mean by creativity, to separate it then from the ideology of creativity, this general advertising propaganda of being a creative, active consumer, a creative consumer, as opposed to the passive consumer of industrial society. In the 50s and 60s, we were all passive consumers. We were seduced by advertising. We loved the advertisements, we gawked at them, we sat there with our mouths open and we went out and bought the products. But now we are much more discerning. You're not going to be fooled, we're far more sophisticated, we can see through all those ads. So a discerning, critical, creative consumer is constructed in the kind of consumption zones that we find. What shifts then in terms of putting this in terms of the cultural sphere is that once we spoke of the culture industry, here from Germany itself, the concept emerges amongst the Frankfurt School thinkers, Adorno, Horkheimer, and it was a critical concept. Culture industry didn't mean something good, it meant something to be examined, something negative, something unpacked, to see what problems of culture we had arrived at, where the dialectic of enlightenment had only produced a new form of captivity to entertainment and to mindless consumption. But culture industry is hardly a term used anymore. We have arrived at the age of the creative industries. And the way we use the word creative industries, there is not a hint of irony in the usage anymore. We see it as a regular, normal, standard extension of the consumption society, and therefore as something that we might actually now plug the art school into, that the function of the art school, and by art I here mean visual arts, music, drama, opera, film, we must plug them into the creative industries. The last point then is that we reach a situation where we move through various definitions of the knowledge producer. The artist as knowledge producer first emerges as the unschooled knowledge producer. Early artists, if you think of right up to about the 60s, it was very possible to come across artists who went to the academy, went to the art school in England, who had never done any schooling beyond their A levels or something, even that. In fact, in that period, just after the war in Britain, because so many people who had been demobbed and had begun hanging about, the soldiers who had come back from the wars were hanging about on the streets, that one solution the government found was to round them up and send them to art school, So if we look at our great artists in England, some of our greatest artists were really young soldiers who would never have got into art school if there hadn't been a war, and would never have got into art school through the normal route. But great artists like Richard Hamilton, like Eduardo Paolozzi, like Ron Kitaj, this generation really went into the Slade only because of this general demobbing, as it were, that took place, and troublesome or potential hooligans were sent off into the art schools to train as artists. So that was that generation. And they eventually, we are often struck by the depth of their intelligence and the depth of their knowledge. If they had so little schooling, we are still impressed by the range of their reading, especially Eduardo Paolozzi, who comes from an Italian immigrant background to Scotland, hardly has much education, whose father was an ice cream seller, sold ice creams from a trolley, and who really throughout, up to quite deep into the war, so liberal and open it seems Britain was at the time, went off every summer to Mussolini's fascist camps with his cousins in Italy, and then came back to Scotland. It seemed that this strange sort of background produces, however, an extraordinarily interesting mind. And I think he was professor here for a bit in Hamburg, and then, of course, at the Royal College of Art eventually. And interesting that this notion of the unschooled, untutored artist is still an important one for us to bear in mind as we are moving pell-mell towards the idea of the highly educated, highly trained doctor of visual arts as we are aiming for the PhD, and I'm all for it, but I think one has to have the skepticism and questioning there. In fact, unschoolability of the artist was the principle of the art school. Why wasn't it the university? Because the people in the art school were unschoolable. You couldn't teach them, they couldn't learn, they couldn't listen, they couldn't sit for an hour to listen to a lecture, as I'm inflicting a lecture on you, it seems. They couldn't do this. They were too fidgety. They were incapable of the discipline that we associate with the university students. All these stereotypical ideas, but maybe quite true, were associated with the unschoolability of the artist. And it becomes really quite a part of the mythography of the artist. In fact, the more unschoolable you were later on, the more chic it was that, oh, you didn't go to school, how wonderful, and yet you're a genius artist, you know, this type of a thing. And we have this tradition right up to Tracy Emin. So if you think of Tracy Emin today, she's the last kind of young fossil left from this tradition of the unschoolable, uncontrollable, rebellious, unfocused mind, but of course brilliant in other respects. Many of her comments, her thoughts, her insights into art and society as a whole, often stunning. So unschoolability. But then we move on to the notion of the artist as the auteur. The artist as some special, based largely on the filmmaker, who has a distinctive voice, who will research and produce knowledge through his or her art that would be have the special stamp and an aura. As we move into a post-auratic age, maybe we toy with the post-colonial artist as the ethnographer, the artist as ethnographer, that knowledge is produced about cultures. Knowledge in art is not about making a work of art that you stand and gawp at as a decorative object or as an ornamental thing, but as an analytical statement about the world, and that it becomes almost seamlessly continuous with cultural studies, this kind of art making, the artist as ethnographer. And at last we arrive in our times where the artist is expected to train for a job in the culture industries, better to set up his or her own industry, and we arrive at the artist as entrepreneur. So the last moment, and I'm sorry if I'm trotting on anyone's corns, but the idea of the artist as entrepreneur must be also under critical scrutiny. We can't just digest this without question. And maybe the last image, then we have these various forms traditionally, Polyander from Greek times, the public expert, Epistemon, the technician or the technical expert of society, Eudoxius, the idiot. Now, the idiot here is not as we might use it in contemporary English. Idiot here means more someone who has an idiolect, who has such a distinctively individual voice or vision that we admire that person for being almost like that unschoolable artist, right? They've retained their sense of autonomous self. And therefore, the idiot comes out as the point of potential critical production against the public expert who wants to talk and manage society and constantly oversee it, and the technician or the technocrat. I felt later I should have probably typed that up as technocrat, especially since today two technocratic prime ministers have been appointed in the Mediterranean, dare I mention it, in Germany, but in Greece and in Italy, we're told, very neutral technocratic experts have been appointed to run the country and bring it back to full employment. So the idiot today might be the geek or the nerd. And we must leave aside the sort of stereotypical notion of the geek and the nerd, who often, when you begin to describe the geek or the nerd visually, just really looks like a person with a bad haircut, sloppy dress, bad glasses, and so on. But at the same time, we're talking about people who are capable of unpredictable innovations and unpredictable behavior. And that unpredictable strand in the geek interests me and brings the geek back into relationship in contemporary times with the art producer. Not the art producer heading for the culture creative industries, but let's say the art practitioner who is indeterminate. We still can't fix a term to it. So this is unschoolability. And maybe in Britain, as we face a terrible crisis next year with the fees at such a rate and the fact that our education will become largely commoditized as really commodities we can sell on the luxury market to people who can afford it, as we fear this moment, we can also see from the history of the last 10 or 15 years to what extent the research exercise in Britain, the RAE, the research assessment exercise, to some extent added to this process of shaping art research and knowledge and the making of the artist into something that you can measure and you can give a mark to. And the scoring of the mark meant that the rating and the ranking of the particular university or art department goes up. And this would be my general fear. I think there is a research excellence assessment in Germany, but maybe in Britain we did go down this road in a very, very severe way, in a very, very heavy-handed way. And though many assessors of the assessment exercise of what is research in visual arts practice, such as Sir Gareth Roberts, where in the famous or well-known Roberts report, did say that it was extremely difficult for us to assess what is knowledge, what is research when it comes to art practice. How do we assess it? How do we give it a mark against the marks we give to a sociology department or an anthropology department or history department, can we create this kind of equal ruler through which we measure, equal yardstick through which we measure the academic disciplines and their notion of research excellence and what we understand by excellence in art practice. And it can only be measured, I think, by a Duchampian ruler. And think of those wonderful rulers that Duchamp toyed with around 1913, 1916, which are in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. But the standard stoppages is a fantastic questioning of what is measurable and what cannot be measured in respect to the intensity of what we are observing, the intensity of the artwork or the art production, which cannot be measured against the kind of protocol-based notions of research, let us say, in a sociological project. Mind you, much of this is blending and dissolving on the edges as increasingly from physics to biology to sociology to history, it is increasingly becoming normal. I leave it to you to wonder why. It's increasingly becoming normal to attach an artist to the research project of the department. Why? Does this artist bring in unpredictable new questions, risk the whole protocol of the department? Or is it a sop to the idea that many forms of knowledge can be deeply steeped in a kind of subjectivity that the academic disciplines dare not, spell out altogether. So the RAE leads to a particular kind of academicization, one might say, if that's not too strong, of the visual arts field, until we arrive today with the forms of experiment we are trying out in Sweden, that is, thinking through the visual. Thinking through the visual in the double sense that you can hear in the English phrase, thinking through the visual where the visual is a vehicle through which you investigate the world, but thinking through the visual, thinking each moment of its phases, thinking how it ticks from within, thinking what its imminent drive might be, thinking, getting under the skin of the process. This thinking through forms the basis of the kind of thinking and knowledge production that we might want roughly to map and associate with the visual in research and knowledge production, as I say, as is the model that is being tested, examined, and scrutinized in the Swedish setting. Is there an image after this? This is the last one, is there? There is there? Oh, right. It's a line from Keats. Keats speaks of the honey in his famous Ode to Indolence, which I am deeply interested in, the state of joblessness or indolence. You can see even the word dole appears in it, though etymologically it isn't quite associated with the dole that we identify with unemployment and the unemployment benefits office, the welfare office, the job center plus, and so on, that is part of the research project. But Keats speaks of a state of mind in which one is not actively at work. Is this the state of creativity, the true state of creativity? And that is one of the questions that is asked in Romantic poetry quite a bit, but it's also asked again in Henri Poincaré's famous writings on the creativity of mathematics. So we have an interesting ally in thinking what creativity is produced out of the state of non-work, out of a state of nishkam karma, that is, out of this inaction, rather than an activist, productivist notion of being in the world. Keats called it a state of negative capability, that you didn't go out. I suppose negative capability, as the negative dialectics, was an invention of Adorno's and the Frankfurt School in the face of the all too positive fate of the dialectic in Eastern Europe, looking at the dead end of the dialectic in the so-called socialist systems. The negative dialectic emerges as a thought criticism in Germany. So sleep, laziness, idleness, the state of being on the dole, are these states that we should re-explore in terms of a long tradition of non-work. In Uddevalla today, we have a beautiful work by a professor from Hamburg Art Academy, Inga Svala Thorsdottir, a work which is centered around sleep. Sleep, the most misunderstood or least understood phase of consciousness. In the West, we want to be awake, or we can cope with dreaming. In the East, we have to deal also with the creativity of sleep. The great gods go to sleep, go into the deep cosmic sleep for aeons. The universe remains uncreated until eventually the lotus blossom emerges from the navel of the god Vishnu floating on the cosmic waters, and the first phase of sleep awakens into creation, only waiting for the dance of destruction of the god Shiva before we enter into the state of sleep again. So sleep is an extremely important stage of the collection of capabilities and potentialities for creation, not as this waste of time in sleeping that we have come to understand it. So in this very sketchy model of indolence, through which one hopes to examine again what we mean by work, and is essentially this work has always been associated with, since Max Weber, with Protestantism and so on. But if you read the Buddhist texts too, you find that there's great concentration on work there too. And there too, there is a great scolding given to people who are idle or waste their time sleeping and lounging about. So I was quite interested that there is a work ethic as much in Buddhism as Max Weber claimed for Protestantism. But in the global assembly line, in remapping values, labor, work, creativity, knowledge, we have to take on board all these different systems of thinking in the hope that we might be able to build up a new map of the contemporary around us, and then try to understand what the relations are between the university, the art school, knowledge, innovation, and creativity. Thank you.